Tuesday, May 22nd, Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee.
I'm starting.
So first, I want to make an announcement. We're not going to be holding a work session on House Bill 5019, the Oregon Department of Education, today. That's going to be moved over until this for this Thursday. So Thursday, May 24th, we will be doing a work session for 5019, the Department of Education. And today we will be having a work session, when I get a quorum, on 5044, okay, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. So we'll be doing that today and tomorrow. And as we speak, I see we have a quorum, so I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 5044, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And before I turn it over to Steve Bender, I wanted to call up Mr. Dennis Johnson from the Department of Ed to talk with us briefly about the affirmative action plan of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, which we have not yet discussed. And Mr. Johnson, thank you for being here. And also, committee members, on your desk, you have the Oregon Student Assistance Commission Affirmative Action Plan, which has been distributed. So, Mr. Johnson, thank you for being here today.
Good afternoon. Thank you. For the record, I'm Dennis Johnson, Executive Director of the Student Assistance Commission. And I apologize for the fact that you didn't have this plan before. We simply didn't know of that requirement. It would have been in your binders previously when we appeared before you in the hearings. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I'll start with just a small capsule so you have an overview. As you're aware, we're a small agency with just around 23 full-time employees, but that doesn't mean we can't have a big impact in this area. I would call your attention, I guess, to page 7, and I'm hoping the version that you have is the same one that matches mine here, where we talk about developing a plan and training, education, and development that we intend to do with our staff. We do have procedures, policies in place to work with new employees and ongoing employees, and managers have responsibility to implement this affirmative action plan. On page 7, we talk a little bit about training, but there are some things that we've been working on that aren't included here. We didn't include examples. One is just being able to respond quickly. That's one thing that a small agency can do. We found we were doing nothing really in the area of disabilities. And through an opportunistic meeting, one of our partners introduced me to the head of a Portland area foundation who works with disability issues, furthering opportunities for persons with disability. We've got a trainer for our fall workshops. We are going to use the expertise, in other words, that we don't have ourselves to help us train our staff, in this case train Aspire volunteers who work out in school systems around the state, and how to help students with disabilities expanding their opportunities. So opportunities like that come up, and that you see reflected here. On page 9, you see who is really responsible for this. Ultimately, the executive director of the agency, that would be me, and program managers. There is an opportunity that appears just because of a vacancy. Sarah Piper has moved on to another opportunity. When it is determined exactly what the future of Aspire will be, we will have a new manager for that program. How we handle that recruitment, of course, is kind of a test of our commitment to affirmative action. Where we advertise, what professional organizations we network among, and what kinds of candidates we surface, not just their sensitivity, but their backgrounds as well. As you can imagine, for any small agency, we're limited somewhat by just the local demographics. We're not going to get a lot of people relocating But even with the limitations and even with the size, if you look at the last sentence on page 10, we are less than one full-time employee away from meeting parity goals in each of the affirmative action, equal employment opportunity, job categories, except for the disabled group category. I mentioned special efforts that we're undertaking in that area right now. I'm sailing ahead as fast as I can. The only other thing I'd like to point out is that because of some of the work that we do, we get some unique opportunities in the area of affirmative action. We have whole sections of our website. We have whole publications that are available now in Spanish language, very important for outreach to underserved populations, especially in a state with a growing Hispanic population, to be able to work with students and their families in the Spanish language. So we've been able to accomplish some of that. That doesn't mean we don't have more work to do. More of our training in the future is going to concentrate on cultural competency. We're going to do some targeted work in the area of sexual harassment. Certainly, ongoing efforts that we have will continue and be expanded into other areas. AmeriCorps, the federal program, we have a very active AmeriCorps group, and many of our volunteers out in the schools are AmeriCorps members. That training in diversity is something that we'd like to have for the rest of our staff, for the rest of our employees. So, again, it's kind of an opportunistic situation. That doesn't come through in a 29-page report on how we plan to do this. I want to assure you that we take this very seriously and that we take it seriously because we see our role as not just good stewards of funds and state employees, but also as educators. That's what we do. We work with our staff. We work with students all over the state of Oregon. Open to any questions.
Any questions? Well, we appreciate the report and the time that you spent today and for your efforts. So thank you very much for coming up today on short notice. And we're going to go forth and talk about the Student Assistance Commission. So okay. more about it. So thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Okay, before I turn over to, I keep saying this, it's going to be 4 o'clock. Before I turn it over to Steve Bender, there are two of our colleagues are in the room, Representative Brian Clem and Representative Peter Buckley, who wanted to come in and briefly discuss their observations about the Aspire program, and they promised that they'd be brief, and we haven't had a full-blown discussion today about Aspire, but well, thank you very much for taking the time out of your days to come here, and we appreciate it. And Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County. I just want to very briefly put in a plug for the Aspire program. Our House committee heard the bills on the Aspire program and passed the House with a substantial majority. The program's outstanding. If I could just put it in this framework, if you love the shared responsibility model, and I do, I think that's a step that our state has to make. The Aspire program is absolutely essential to make the shared responsibility model work. Aspire reaches students in the high school, mentors them on their path outside of high school in a way that's cost-effective, it uses volunteers, it's a flat-out outstanding program. When I visited Phoenix High School about 2 years back and did a presentation with their AP government class, 28 students at Phoenix High School, bright kids, fantastic kids. Of the 28, only 24 were even investigating going to college because they had in their mind that they could not afford a college education. Aspire reaches those kids, has a proven track record. The governor had in his budget, I think, $1.3 million for Aspire, which allows to expand it to two-thirds of the high schools. It was going to come somewhere around there. But a substantial expansion of the Aspire program. I just wanted to make a pitch for the program, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Brian Clem from State Representative District 21 here in Salem, and I'm the Vice Chair of the Higher Ed Committee. But the one thing I wanted to say, because you probably either have heard in your earlier budget testimony about the merits of the Aspire program, or you just heard a little bit, but now, I was Chair of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for the last 4 years, was on it for six, and I care very deeply about the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Aspire program. And I would say, if you have the choice in front of you on whether to fund the Aspire program, even if it has to come out of the Oregon Opportunity Grant expansion and slightly, you know, tweak one of the hydraulics, that you should do it. Because the Aspire program, and I've had dozens of conversations over the years with the foundation's executives who have been funding this thing on behalf of the state for the last 10 years, it is a wonderful program, but the foundations who paid for it, they incubated it to make sure it would work. It clearly works. Now it's about expanding it to 186 high schools, which is what the governor's recommended budget level did. Or if you want to get it into every high school, I think there's an ask from the students originally this session that is even more. But, you know, I know sometimes you get the Solomon choice where it's got to come from somewhere, and I'm here to say that even as a big advocate for the opportunity grant shared responsibility model, I would say you could adjust the hydraulic a little bit and take the million or so from there.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Morgan.
Thank you. Representative Clem, I had the pleasure of working with the OSAC budget during the time that you were the board chair, and that was, I got to know you and really appreciated your service. You led the organization through a very difficult time when we lost the federal grants, and I really appreciate what you did to make that right. I think that was very well done. The another issue that we have in this budget is the student child care program was transferred over, but the funding was taken away for it. So currently, I think we're waiting for any more information that we can get, but it appears that that program has been zero funded in the co-chair's budget also. From your experience with students and the Student Assistance Commission, can you talk to us about how important you think that program is?
Child care block grant? Yeah, I would be happy to. One of the problems is the mechanic of the program. We're still at DHS while I was chair, so I didn't know every bit of how it worked because it wasn't within the agency, but I actually was here in 05 along with Representative Dalto, both of us testifying in favor of moving it to OSAC, oddly enough. So it sounds to me now like the bill has been passed to move the program, but the budget is not necessarily following. Now, that would be a mistake, obviously, because the program is something that is about access still. It's just a different kind of access. It's for, you know, people who have children. And the way, if I recall, the mechanics worked, well, actually, you know, to be honest, I don't know how the mechanics worked at the agency. I don't know how the grant was delivered. What I could tell you from my experience when I was in student government was we did a program at OSU because there weren't the facilities on campus. We just kind of did a student voucher program through the student government to students to use at a private facility in Corvallis called KinderCare, if I remember right. So we found that the campuses didn't always at that time have the facilities available, and sometimes you need to give the money to the student for an off-campus provider. I, to be honest, don't know how DHS was doing it because we hadn't gotten the program by the time I left, and I never heard how the mechanics were.
Thank you.
Thank you. Fair to say, though, that there's a definitive need, and it's very important.
Yeah, no question.
Would that be accurate?
And it would be a tragedy in just shifting it over to all of a sudden lose the funding that had been there. If it was there last session, that would not be what the purpose in moving the program over was to zero it out and just move the actual program, because OSAC doesn't have extra money floating around to run it.
Last session we increased the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and as you all know, students did not use all the money that we put into that budget. One of the reasons was they weren't aware of that, the access to those opportunities. The Aspire program is, again, the most cost-efficient way to get the information out to the high school students in the state of Oregon, get their paperwork done, get them focused into the shared responsibility model or into other paths such as trade schools, wherever they're going to go, but to give our kids that transition out of high school.
and unlike the shared responsibility model, aspires at needs tested so you can feel good that it is another form of way to help students of all economic strata think about college in your district. So it's not just the neediest of the needy, which is sort of the point of the shared or the opportunity grant. Shared responsibility model helps you move up the income scale as well. So it's got that same sort of feature, and Aspire does dovetail very nicely.
Can you ask one question?
Sure, Representative.
Based on your experience with Aspire, is it a program that benefits students no matter where they are in the state, whether they're in urban areas or rural areas?
As long as it's in your high school. So because of funding, it's not in every high school. But if it is in your high school, then it absolutely does, because it's the same level of kind of it's a non-institutionalized approach where we don't say go to an OUS school. We don't say go to Chemeketa. We don't say go to Willamette. We say we want you to fill out your FAFSA. We want you to take your PSAT, do those essays, and I'm going to meet with you as your volunteer mentor for the last 2 years of your high school career to think about where you go to college. And the only factor that's got the whole urban-rural thing is whether or not the high school has it or not. And so that's where you had to look at the map and see if with more money do all those little stars fill in of where Aspire will be with more funding, and once we get them all, then we solve that problem.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you both, Representative Buckley and Representative Clem, for your work and your advocacy. Appreciate it. All right, now what we've all been waiting for. Well, no, that really sounded bad. We were waiting for you two. Wanted to finally turn it over to Steve Bender, who's going to take us through the LFO recommendation and provide us some information to talk about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been over 2 months since you've had public hearings on this particular budget, and I thought it would be helpful to begin by doing a bit of a review of what's in this budget and what the issues are in the budget, and then to start going through the recommendation. As you all know, one of the major programs in this budget is the Opportunity Grant Program and a proposal to expand the Opportunity Grant Program. We will be talking about that and that expansion today. However, you are scheduled for a work session tomorrow as well, and I think most of the discussions about the shared responsibility model and how it works will be deferred until tomorrow, as will any votes. There isn't any intention to take any votes today. It is just to go through what the budget situation is for OSAC. What I've done is I've distributed to you three items, and I ask you to please try to locate them, and if you have trouble locating them, let me know. One of them is a one-page table that you've seen before for other agencies. This is a comparison of the new co-chair's budget with the governor's budget for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. The other document, which we'll be spending most of the time going through, is a broader set, thicker document that in your copies it has beige paper on the top. Mine has yellow, but yours is beige. That's the actual recommendation language and the details of the recommendation. And then finally, the third item that I distributed to you today is a small item that on the front page it says Oregon Student Assistance Commission Opportunity Grant Award Amounts. This is something that we'll be going through to explain some of the differences between the existing Opportunity Grant program and the proposal to transform it into a shared responsibility model. So if I may just quickly begin, Mr. Chair and members, by asking you to look at the item that the recommendation on the beige paper, and just look at the very front table. The reason I'm asking you to look at this front table is to indicate to you that this is fairly complicated in terms of fund sources. And the Oregon Student Assistance Commission's budget, this agency receives a number of funding sources, and I just wanted to very briefly talk about what these fund sources are and how they're used. As you can see in this table, this agency receives general fund, lottery funds, other funds, federal funds, and non-limited other funds. That's about as many fund sources as you can get. And I'll start with the easy ones. The easiest one, if you go down to the row that says federal funds. Federal funds, all of those dollars, are funds that are received from the federal government and that are used to support the Opportunity Grant Program. That's to say these dollars are simply combined with any state support dollars that you have and help to finance the opportunity grant program. As you can see, in the scope of things, it's not a large amount of money given the size of that program, but it is about $2 million a biennium. Probably the next easiest row to describe, but it's a little more complicated, is the lottery funds number. Lottery funds in this budget, like the federal funds, go entirely to fund the opportunity grant model, the opportunity grant program. And all of those dollars are then combined with additional general fund plus the federal funds we just talked about in order to finance the opportunity grant. The thing that is a little unusual is these lottery dollars are different than the normal lottery dollars that you think of when you're looking at lottery funds and other budgets, because they don't represent the proceeds of lottery games, which is typically what lottery funds are. Instead, they represent the earnings of the Education Stability Fund. Under law and under the Constitution, 18% of lottery earnings go into the Education Stability Fund, which is a fund against which you cannot spend the corpus of the fund without meeting certain requirements, but essentially this is a reserve fund. And the reserve fund has a lot of money in it, and it earns interest, and 25% of the interest earnings are dedicated by law to the Opportunity Grant Program. Those 25% in 07-09 are expected to be almost $9.9 million. And all of those go to the Opportunity Grant. The next item is, I'm going to go to, are the non-limited funds. These are all other funds, and these represent grants that are paid to students that are not limited in the budget, and the primary source of these grant funds, not exclusively, but almost exclusively, represent funds that private donors donate and ask, use the Scholarship Commission as an administrator for their private scholarship programs. These are primarily the funds that the Scholarship Commission is distributing from these private scholarship awards. The other funds number, which is in the middle and in the LFO recommendation, is $5,780,000, represents administrative costs for a number of programs that are funded by other funds. One of the two major programs where you see other funds showing up here are for the administration of the private awards programs. So these are not the funds that are distributed to students, but rather the funds that the agency spends in order to administer those scholarship funds on personnel and other costs. And another major entity in the other funds is the Aspire program. The Aspire program expenditures would be showing up here in other funds. And there are some other programs, too, that we can talk about in a bit more detail, but those are the major ones in other funds. Finally, general fund. General fund, the governor had recommended a $104.8 million, which was up from $76.8 million that was approved this biennium. As you can see, the LFO recommendation is going to be for less than that, $98 million. But in order to discuss the general fund, what I would ask you to do is to turn to page 6 of the document you're looking at, which is the back of the last beige page. It's not easy to read. Beige page. If you look at the back there, and you look at Table A, Table A indicates where the general fund and lottery fund dollars go in the OSAC budget. And these are down to the dollar. These aren't rounded or estimates. These are exactly where these dollars are going. And you can see in the, you start with the 0507 LAB, that's the biennium we're in now, there was $75.7 million of general fund and lottery fund provided for the opportunity grant. This is the only place where there are any lottery funds at all in this first row. All lottery funds are in this first row. Below that, it's just pure general fund. But that's the combination of general fund and lottery fund. The rest of the lottery funds went to three programs: the Rural Health Services Program, which we'll talk more about, the Nursing Services Program, which we'll talk more about, Both of these programs operate in a similar manner in that these do not provide financial aid to students. These provide financial aid to former students. These are monies that are paid to healthcare practitioners who are meeting certain qualifications under law, primarily in terms of serving in rural areas where there is a need for doctors, physician assistants, nurses, other types of medical practitioners. Under these programs, what these dollars are used for are they are used to pay the student loans for former students who are practicing in these rural areas. And that is what those two programs do. The third program... The third program was funded was Oregon Troops to Teachers Program, which was a program to provide financial aid to members who are leaving the military who wished to train, take courses to become teaching, to get teaching careers. There was $165,000 there. And the remainder, $1,651,857, supported agency operations. That's to say the cost of personnel and other administrative costs of the agency.
I'm just curious, of the 0507 legislatively adopted budget, that $75.7 million in the opportunity grant, how much of that was turned back?
We expect there to be the actual expenditures to be about $61 million. So it would be about over $14 million would be coming back. If you go back to Table A and look in the right-hand columns, you can see what the governor's recommendation was. Governor's recommendation is for an increase in total state support of 46% over the prior biennium level. And you can see by different program what those increases are. And you can also look at the LFO recommendation there and see what those increases are. Please note that one of the major, the largest increase in the governor's program was actually percentage terms for the Rural Health Services Program. Second largest was for agency operations, and Opportunity Grant came in third. But of course, most of the money was in the Opportunity Grant because that's by far the largest program. Since we are, if I could now ask you to step back and look at the one-page sheet that compares the new co-chair's budget to the governor's budget, and then I'd like to talk about how the LFO recommendation is different from the new co-chair's budget, because it is not identical. But looking at the new co-chair's budget, I knew this was the one that was released a week or so ago. I'm losing track of the time, but it was the revised one. There is no difference from the governor's budget in terms of support for the opportunity grant. Both budgets provide $47 million above the essential budget level, which is, if you look at row 194, what this results in is an increase over 0507 of about 83%. So that's over the actual expenditures, not what was budgeted for, but the actual expenditures. This is an 83% increase in the Opportunity Grant Program. And you can see when you look at rows 188 and 189, $47 million is for payments to students, and $651,000 is for administrative costs. The new shared responsibility model is much more complex than the existing opportunity grant, and both budgets accommodated additional personnel and expenses in order to actually implement the more complex complex program. And I can tell you that the LFO recommendation will also concur with the numbers in row 189. So our recommendation is also that this thing is going to cost $651,000 to implement the changes. The next major program is the Aspire program. Here you can see there is a difference between the governor's budget and the co-chair's budget. I would like to talk a little bit about the Aspire program and ask you to go back to the page 6 on the beige colored paper, because if you look at Table D, there is detail here on the difference between the two budgets in terms of Aspire. If you look at Table D, you will see that 2005-07, the current biennium, the Aspire program is entirely funded by other funds. There is no general fund, and the other source of these other funds are donations and grants that the agency has received in order to finance this program. The total expenditures are about $1.36 million this biennium, and with these expenditures, the program is serving students in 85 high schools throughout the state. Again, what this program does is the program trains and places volunteer coordinators in these schools. The volunteer coordinators then manage and train volunteers who mentor high school students through the college application and financial aid.
Mr. Bender, do you know how many high schools there are total? What percentage of the high schools are being served?
There are somewhat over 300 high schools. The governor's budget proposal to expand that to 150 would have gotten almost half of the high schools. Slightly less than half. I do not have the number of the exact number of high schools. Do you know that?
No, just that.
No, I didn't. Okay. I did have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Douglas.
On the other funds, Mr. Bender, is it the expectation that the department will be able to generate that much money again in terms of those grants and donations?
Yes. Under what it says under the co-chair's budget and the governor's budget, for other funds, the $1,074,457 is the projection of what we expect to continue to be generated from other funds for this program in the 07-09 biennium. All of these are not secured. It's not guaranteed that all of these dollars will come, but this is the best estimate. And also the number could be higher because this is based on the assumption that there are no new grants out there that the commission applies for and is successful and receives funds for.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
Is the decline in these other grants and donations, is there a clear reason for that? Were some of this money being brought forward from previous biennials, and they just simply don't anticipate the same level as they had in 05-07?
The reason for the decline in funding is that some of the grant sources which have been providing funds in 05-07 are expected to expire. The major grant sources that are expected to expire are, there is an AmeriCorps grant, there are a couple of AmeriCorps grants that are used to assist in funding this program and provide part of these other fund numbers that you see here. And of the AmeriCorps grants, one of them is expected to expire during this period of time, and that's cause of part of the reduction. The other is there's a reduction expected in a GEAR-UP grant, which is also a grant that's initially a federal source grant. Together, approximately the decline in grant resources are expected to be approximately $313,000 from this biennium to next biennium. I'm not sure, I don't think I brought the sheet with me, and maybe I can just get a nod or a comment from the commission. I'm not sure if any of the purely private donations, such as the Ford Foundation has been a big supporter of this program, or am I wrong? But the private donations, I'm not sure those are really expected to go down very much. I think it's mainly the AmeriCorps and the Europe, but I do have that information back in the office, and I can explain that. But in the co-chair's budget, does not accept the general fund infusion into this program. So the agency would only be able to serve an estimated 65 high schools based on the declining amount of other fund revenue. And of the governor's budget, the $1.35 million in general fund that's added is enough to offset to $313,000 decline, plus add another million or so, and that would expand funding to $2.4 million and allow the agency to then set its goal to serve about 150 high schools in the program.
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Bender, can you share with us the discussions, or what the decision points were that the co-chairs came to, that that they based their decision not to put any general fund in this program on?
Yes, I can, and that is consistent with the LFO recommendation as well. And the reason for the we recommended this is are basically two things. One thing is that it is very laudable, we believe, when state agencies are successful in getting grant funds in order to maintain programs or start programs. But we think it's very important that the state not be in a situation where when these funds are reduced, whether they're from private sources or federal sources, mm-hmm. that the state is then in a situation where it's obligated to step in and to make up for this. That's one of the reasons why Ways and Means, as you know, always looks at and approves federal grants applications before the agency even applies. Because Ways and Means is often very concerned that, well, this is nice, when the money runs out, are we going to have an obligation? These funds never were applied, Ways and Means never approved the initial application, because even though some of them were initially from the federal government, they were all received as other funds. And therefore, the law does not require any agency to get Ways and Means approval to apply for a non-federal grant. It's only the federal grants. But we think that there's a similar process here in that we're concerned about the state stepping in as grant award amounts decline, and we also believe there are some incentive concerns that this gives the agencies less incentive to go out and to continue to seek grant awards from new donors for particular programs. Another reason why for the LFO recommendation in this particular case, however, is that we see this primarily as a program that serves K-12 students. As you know, high schools, because of recent difficulties in funding, have had to make some cutbacks in their staff, and as they've attempted to preserve the core teaching staff as much as possible, there's been a tendency to let go of guidance counselors and people who can provide this type of assistance to students. OSAC stepped in very admirably and came up with a program that's very cost-effective that uses volunteers instead of staff to provide this information. But we believe that now, with the funding situation for K-12, it's getting much better under your proposed budgets, and that it would be reasonable for the K-12 school districts to either try to supplement again their guidance counselor services, or if they wish to participate in the Aspire program, that they can use some of their additional funding to pay the cost instead of having essentially OSAC pay half the costs for these Aspire volunteers. So that's the reason for our recommendation. And the co-chairs did concur with that.
So can I... I understand the piece around federal grants going away, and that that is an issue. But so here we have a program that is in OSAC, and I'm presuming that we have some kind of information that shows that this program is actually effective, that it is it is successfully getting kids to do their FAFSAs and take their entrance exams and that kind of thing. Do we have that kind of data on this program?
You received during the public hearing a report on the effectiveness of the Aspire program. That particular report did find that the program was successful in those particular schools where it was operating. I think that report did have some concerns. I had some concerns personally about the methodology that we used, but clearly that report did show positive impact.
So then the co-chairs were thinking that this program would stay within OSAC because obviously it exists there and they have the structure and they've been rolling this program out now, but that somehow that the K-12 system would pay for positions, or I mean, I don't get how functionally you would take money out of K-12 and use it to fund the Aspire program.
The co-chairs were more concerned, I believe, about the question of the expiration of the grants and the policy issue of having the state then supplement situations where private grant funding is being reduced. However, the program could operate in this manner of the total amount of the general fund. If you look at Table A, you can see there's a row that says Aspire portion to schools only. About $671,000 would be funds that would be transferred to the schools. And what the schools would use these funds for would be to pay essentially half of the cost of the volunteer coordinators that are located there. It's been a cooperative program, and the schools have been paying half, and OSAC's been paying the other half from the funds that you see here. What LFO is suggesting is that in this, given the fiscal situation of schools, they could agree to pay for more than half of the cost if they wish to implement this program in their schools. There's nothing to prevent them from doing that. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you. Going back to the one-page sheet here that compares the new co-chair's budget and the governor's budget. Well, let me, before doing that, let me just say that if you look at row 208, just to wrap up, is Aspire. Compared to the prior biennium, the co-chair's budget has a 21% reduction in funding, and the governor's budget has a 79% increase in funding. Other programs, there are a number of other programs here where there are some major differences between the two budgets, and some of those are addressed in the LFO recommendation, and some of them aren't. In the interest of time, I think what I'd like to do is go back to page 6 and look at Table B. Where Table B looks at differences between the LFO recommendation and the co-chair's budget. And we will need to go into these in some detail. After this, I'd sort of like to start going through the recommendations fairly sequentially. But I did want to note that there are some differences. And the first difference is the following. These represent the difference in general fund in the co-chair's budget and the LFO recommendation. And the bottom line is the LFO recommended general fund is about $3.5 million less than what was in the co-chair's budget for a number of reasons. There are four reasons. The first reason is that since the governor's budget was submitted, we've had new forecasts, as you know, of lottery revenues. Even though this is an unusual type of lottery revenue in this budget, it's not the direct earnings, it's the earnings on the Education Stability Fund. Nonetheless, like the regular earnings of the lottery, these earnings are up. And we're expecting more of them than when the governor put the budget together. In fact, we're expecting $372,140 more in lottery funds than was anticipated when the governor submitted his budget. We're therefore recommending that you use these funds, that is to say the lottery funds which are dedicated for that purpose and which cannot be used for anything else, and you shift those funds for general fund. This frees up $372,140 in general fund, which is available to the legislature for any general fund purpose without having an impact on the total amount of funding for opportunity grants. The next item is an addition, not a subtraction, and we'll go into this in more detail. We recommended adding $200,000 that was not in the co-chair's budget, and that was in the governor's budget, for the Office of Degree Authorization so that they can maintain their current staffing
and meet some expected or possible Attorney General charges that they will be facing. The third item will take some explanation, and I just want to mention it now without going into detail. It refers to the Jobs Plus program and how that program's operating. We are recommending changes that would generate $309,000 of funding for the Opportunity Grant and thereby allow you to free up $309,000 of general fund without, again, affecting the total funding for the Opportunity Grant. But you would now be able to use that money for other purposes. And finally, the recommendation includes a $3 million reduction in funding for the Opportunity Grant. This is not, unlike the other one, the other number one and three, where it didn't affect the total. This is an actual reduction in the shared responsibility model funding of $3 million for a total of approximately $3.5 million difference.
So the inevitable question is, who gets to spend the 3.5?
Who gets to spend the 3.5?
We do.
I think we do. Perhaps.
Fortunately.
What do you think, Senator Dublin?
I think we get to spend a portion of it.
I think we do.
A mystery.
It's great.
Question.
You're finding money.
Just in case anybody saw it, but I think there's an explanation for it. You know, 2003-2005, we saw a non-limited $40 million. That's when they still had the student loan program within the budget, right?
Correct.
So, okay.
And those were generally non-limited, those expenditures.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, I'd like to start getting into some of the details of the recommendation. And I'm going to be going through and starting on page 2. And again, Mr. Chair, my understanding is you're not going to be taking any votes on this today. Is that correct? You just want an explanation of what is here.
Correct.
The first recommendation is to make a technical change that basically deals with the situation that I believe you're all aware of, that in the current biennium, utilization of the share of the Opportunity Grant has fallen below what was expected and budgeted for. The essential governor noted that this was happening and made an adjustment to the essential budget level, because the essential budget level is designed to be a calculation of what it would cost to maintain a program that you've got into the upcoming biennium. And when we found out that this program was much less expensive than it appeared, the governor made an adjustment to account for that in the budget.
I'm confused. So when you say is much less expensive than first appeared, is that because of the $13 million coming not being spent?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. They made an adjustment, but then, again, well, because the budget process takes so many months, as time goes by, we get more information. And it became clear after the governor's budget was submitted that the adjustment that they made was not enough, because the actual cost of the program, it turned out, was even less than was anticipated back when the governor was putting their budget together. So we believe it's important to start off with an essential budget level that really does represent what we believe the cost of the program would be. So that then you can either add to that or subtract to it as you see fit.
So can I ask a really dumb question?
Senator Decker.
So students who are planning for their school year today, for next school year, and then obviously their future commitments, how are, I don't know how you factor that into, as we plan for the 07-09 budget, you've thought this through. Someone has thought this through of, they are not gauging whether the legislature is going to act upon the share, I don't think,
no.
The share. So you, all I need is, yeah, nod that we factor that in, we've thought that through, and...
Mr. Bender, isn't it that, Mr. Chair, we're going to continue with the existing package for the first year of this biennium
and introduce...
And not do the shared responsibility model to the second year.
And spend some money to introduce this concept, and market it, and... Right. And we are spending money to do...
And
yes.
And none of that has anything to do with the essential budget level, because the essential budget level assumes only the cost of existing or current programs. So basically, central budget level does not include any costs for the shared responsibility model. Those would have to be in a package, and we'll get to that in a bit. Okay, so this is really a technical adjustment. It's not. We're not even asking you to reduce funding. We're just asking you to approve the change in the calculation of the essential budget level by reducing what was in the governor's budget by an additional $7.9 million general fund to get to what we now expect to be the actual cost of maintaining the existing program.
So can I just see clarity on this? There was $13 million the total amount that was turned back, or was there actually more than that turned back?
Actually, we don't know exactly yet because, of course, the biennium isn't done, and there are still payments that the Student Assistance Commission is going to be making for that program. The amount that will be turned back is, I believe, going to be greater than $13 million. I believe the number that is closer to $15
million. So then the $7.9 million that you are lowering the that's your adjustment downwards, how does that relate to the $15 million? Why is it so much less?
The reason it's less is because the governor had already made a reduction earlier. The governor knew that the program was not going to cost as much as it ended up costing. There was less information available at that time, so they made a reduction part of the total, and then this is the reduction to the remainder of.
So the total reduction then is $15 million less whatever the roll-up is.
Let me see if I can, yes, that's what it is, and I think I could probably get you an exact number here.
No, I'm just trying to conceptually get this.
Conceptually, that's what it is. But we do make adjustments for the roll-up because of the cost in the upcoming biennium. It's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be exactly the cost that it was in this biennium. It's going to increase.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm constantly amazed at how this governor can do these incredible calculations and do all these things with the amount of work he has to do.
The governor has staff.
Yes.
I'm sure he has a huge staff.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Devlin. So basically what we're trying to do here with the ABL, because we're going to do the first year this coming biennium under the existing model, the existing opportunity grant model. So we want to make sure that in the first year we're pretty much on target with what we anticipate in that first year.
I actually think that all we're really doing is chewing up the budget and getting the right information to start off, because we want to be able to, we need to know how much we're going to add for the shared responsibility model or whatever other changes you make. So we're starting with the base of how much it would cost if you don't do that, and then you're adding $47 million or whatever.
Okay. And that's, but in essence, you're starting with the base for both years and then adding to the second year to convert to the other model.
In package 101, yes. If so you wanted to add for both years, you would have presumably put more in package 101.
Representative Morgan.
Is there something in here that shows us in a table where what the corrected EBL is and where the roll-ups are from there?
Probably not, but I will, let me check. The way this is, we're kind of limited in the way that we can enter information in the work session action report that you see here, so we can't show that. I will get that information for you tomorrow, though.
Okay,
I'll just have to
you
generate it separately, construct it separately. Okay. Recommendation two is the recommendation to use the extra lottery funds that we didn't know we were going to have, or that the governor didn't know that were going to be available in the governor's budget. That's the $372,140, which we talked about. The recommendation is to use those funds instead of the general fund, and therefore I free up that general fund amount for whatever it is that your highest need would be. Package recommendation three deals with the big policy option package. That's package 101, and this is the funding to implement the shared responsibility model. And the LFO recommendation is, as I mentioned earlier, $3 million less than was in the co-chairs. As you see here from the co-chairs, that was $47 million. So the LFR recommendation was $44 million. It's also to include the funding for administration, which is $651,000. There are a couple of other, I wouldn't call them minor adjustments, but other adjustments to what the governor's recommendation was, and those, there are two of them. One of them is to take one of the added positions and to make it into a limited duration position instead of a permanent position. It's a little unclear at this point what the workload would be for that new individual. And as a limited duration position, the agency could review workload, and if they believe that they need to continue with this person, they can request again next biennium that it be reassigned, reauthorized. The other change is that of the $651,000, roughly $250,000 is for contracts, so that the agency can, if it chooses to do so, enter into contracts for consulting services to help develop and model and run the shared responsibility model. What we're recommending is, we're not recommending that you don't provide that funding. We're recommending that you unschedule those funds, or request DAS to unschedule those funds, $250,000. What unscheduling means is that the agency does not have access to spend them. DAS says, no, you can't spend this money, even though it's been appropriated. And that they would keep these funds unscheduled pending a review by LFO and DAS of an agency request to fund professional service contracts. So in other words, we want to see what it is they want to contract for and whether they really need these funds before they're actually released. This will be done at the staff level, and that is the recommendation regarding that. I would like to talk a bit about the impact of Policy Option Package 101, first on the budget, and then second on individual students. So looking at the first on the overall budget situation, if you could again turn to page 6, please. This time we'll look at the Table C. The Table C looks at the impact of Policy Option Package 101 at different funding levels on the state budget. And the left-hand column there, this shows what we're anticipating the general fund and lottery fund expenditures for opportunity grants to be this biennium without the shared responsibility model. In addition to these $61.181 million, there's also about $2 million in federal funds on top of this, and about $300,000, or I think it's less this biennium, on top of that, and some other funds, which we'll get to later. So the total cost isn't $61, but the general fund and lottery fund portion is. The next column there shows Policy Option Package 101 at various funding levels. In the LFO recommendation, it's $44 million, so that's why that row is shaded. The co-chairs and the governor's level is $47 million. You see that number there. And there are just other numbers here, just to show the relationship between what this really means. What does it really mean when you say we're giving $44 million? What that means is that the total funding available for opportunity grants in 07-09, the biennium you're funding from all sources, not just from general fund and lottery, but adding in the federal, the total amount of grants would be, at $44 million, would be $107 million. Now, why are those numbers different? The difference is that there is $63 million in the central budget level. Once you make that adjustment, there's $63 million in the central budget level, and if you add $44 million, that means there'll be $107 million altogether. If you add $30 million, there'll be $93 million altogether. So you can see in that column is always exactly $63 million above the column right to the left of it. But what is being proposed is not to fund the shared responsibility model for both years. It's only to fund the shared responsibility model for one of the 2 years, the second year of the biennium. What this next column, second year funding, is it's the number for the full cost minus 34 million. So for every row, you take off 34 million, you get the second year funding. The reason we're doing that is we're projecting the cost of the existing program to be $34 million in the current, you know, in the first year of the next biennium. So if you have, you know, if you approve $44 million, there'll be $107 million altogether. If they need $34 million to fund the first year, that means OSAC will have $73 million left for funding the shared responsibility model for the 1 year that it would operate under this proposal. Then the question is, what happens, not 07-09, but 09-11? Because in 09-11, you've got the shared responsibility model for both years of the biennium. Again, in this case, I took out the federal funds and the other funds, and I said, well, let's just look at focus on our general fund and lottery. Basically, what happens is the cost doubles because you're funding it for 2 years instead of 1 year. So you have to take the second year funding and double it. But if you look at these numbers closely, you'll see they're slightly more than doubled. Under the budget process, the essential budget level would allow a standard inflation adjustment for the amount. This biennium was 3.4%. For the purposes of these estimates, and these are just estimates, I just used even 4%. So basically we're estimating here that the cost next biennium would be about $150 billion.
Pardon?
Million.
Did I say billion?
Yes. Oh,
sorry, million.
It feels like a billion.
And the column to the final column on the right, 2.4, what that's doing is that's comparing the cost, really, of the shared responsibility model to the current. In other words, it's increasing the amount of student aid by 2.4 times what we're funding now. So we're more, you know, we're doubling it in half again. That's basically the size at this level of funding. If, for example, you approve $30 million in Package 101, you'll be really doubling the size of amount of student aid. So that's the relationship. It's not obvious. So that's why I showed this table. But $30 million doubles it. About $50 million would triple it. That's the relationship. And the proposal is about 2.4 times. That's the amount, the impact on the state budget. Now, what does that mean to individual students?
So before you go there, so you chose 4%?
I did chose 4%. We don't know what the number will be yet. It varies each biennium based on the inflation rate. So typically, like this biennium, for example, these payments were allowed to be inflated by 3.1%, or was it 3.4? 3.1% from one biennium to the next. It might be 3.1% again, but inflation's been pretty low in the past, and it seems to be heating up. I just picked 4%. If it's 5% or 6%, the numbers would change. So it's only a projection. Okay. Representative Morgan.
Mr. Bender, there was also another aspect of this. If I'm not mistaken, and my memory is working properly, which is highly suspect, that there were some errors made in the computation of the number of students that could be served, and so there actually is less students that are able to be served with this amount of investment than was originally thought. Are you going to talk to us about what the shape of that is at some point?
I would like to address that either later today or tomorrow.
Thank you.
Yes, please proceed. Just been alerted that the Senate meets on the floor at 4:30, so we're certainly going to allow our Senate colleagues to vote.
Senator Decker, just a quick, Steve, this, I know you don't have unlimited research opportunities, and I look forward to, if we're done with policy option 3, that is just a huge investment from the state that I look forward to voting for. But if you look at other states, I know of no state, we get an F in measuring up in terms of our commitment to post-secondary access. But states that do really well in access, Washington, California being really close by, who do really well, they also have a commitment towards their institutions that Oregon never has had for post-secondary education. And so I'm not sure who's here that's going to be here for a long time. But I think when we vote yes on this, we just have to marry that with, because I know no state that's done, I don't think there is one, that's done a commitment on access that we're about to do. And you must, I think, marry that with a commitment to something that students would want to go to. And to me, it's almost chief, and it's not embedded in these numbers, is that equal co-commitment that we have to make once we approve this package here, is the equivalent commitment and have revenues to do it.
Thank you, Senator. I'd like to ask you to please look at this other item handout that we haven't looked at yet, which talks about the opportunity grant and compares or shows some information about the current program and the proposed program, and so you can see what some of the impacts will be on students. On the top page here, this shows the proposed award amounts. And as you can see, 2007-08, these are the proposed award amounts for the first year of the upcoming biennium, the award year that we believe will cost $34 million in total to provide the awards that you see here. And the award levels are as follows. All community college students receive, who are full-time students for the full year, would receive $1,470. If you qualify as a half-time student or more, but are not full-time for the full year, you would get half this amount. The part-time awards are one-half the full-time awards. The Oregon University System amount is less than $300 higher than the community college amount. Well, as you know, the tuition differential between those two is much greater than that. But the Oregon University System amounts, regardless of what school you go to, if you're full-time, you get $1,752. Then for the other institutions, OHSU and the private institutions that qualify for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the amounts are not common. They vary. And if you look at these numbers for 07-09, you can see that they vary from a low of 1,932 for students of Mount Angel Seminary to a high of 4,956 for students who are at Reed College. These variances are based on differences in the costs of tuition and other between the independent institutions. The important thing to note about the existing program is that every student who qualifies gets the same amount. So if you qualify and you're in the Oregon University System and you're there for the full year, you'll get $1,752, as will every other recipient. If you want to see who qualifies, please turn to the second page. These are the income cutoffs based on household incomes of how much money you can make and still get these awards. And it depends upon whether you're a dependent student or an independent student, and it depends upon your household size. So if you're a dependent student, if you're dependent on your parents or other guardian, and you come from a household size of, say, there are four people, and you're one of those four, up to an income level of $33,600. If you're at the Oregon University System, you would then get $1,752. If your income is $3,700, you get zero. These are the cutoffs.
Can you do that one more time?
Sure. Sorry. If you are a dependent student, which is to say you're dependent and receiving financial support from parents or guardians, and you come from a household size where there are four people altogether, you would qualify for a opportunity grant as long as the household income, which is being reported on the financial aid form that's being filed, does not exceed $33,600. If you're above that number, even if you're 33.7, you get zero. If you're below that number, wherever you are, whether you're at 33.6 or whether you're at 15.6, you get the amounts that are shown on the front page. Depends upon where you're attending. And again, if you're part-time, you get half that. And if you're only there for one of the three terms, you get a third of it, and you don't get it for the terms that you're not there. Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin.
thinking right up. I just get a clarification. These are gross income numbers, right? Not adjusted income numbers for these parents.
I see. Yes.
Yeah. So in other words, if I'm part of a young couple and we have a baby daughter and I'm making $25,300 a month and my wife is going to go to school and I get a raise, she gets disqualified for a grant. Is that about?
Yes.
Okay.
Under the shared responsibility model, award sizes will tend to increase and more students will be served generally. But one of the major changes is that the award amounts are not the same for everyone. They vary for each student by their income levels. So to show that, this is the latest run that the governor's office has done of the proposal that they would ask you to support. And it shows the, I'm sorry it's complicated, but it's complicated because people get a lot of different award amounts depending upon their status. One thing that you will note that simplifies this is the left-hand set of tables are for full-time students, and then you have a middle set of tables and a right-hand set of tables for students who are more than half-time but not full-time, and for students that are half-time. Actually, though, the awards for the more than half-time students and the half-time students are identical, so you don't really need, I mean, you can see the number of recipients, but in terms of the award amounts, there's, again, one award for the part-time students and one for the full-time students. Typically, generally, the award for the half-time students will be greater than half for the full-time students. You know, now it's half of what the full-time students get. Typically, it will be greater than that, but not always. It depends upon all of these circumstances. But let's just, probably the easiest way to look at this is to pick a particular student and to see how they fare compared to what they had before. Let's go back to the dependent student who had four persons in their household and had an income where they qualified and was attending an OUS institution. An income where you might qualify would be if you had an income of $31,000 and you were a dependent student with four people in your household, you would have qualified under the current plan. And because you qualify, if you go back to the front page, you would see that if you were a full-time OUS student, you would have gotten an award, you would qualify for an award of $1,752. If you want to see what that same person would get under the shared responsibility model, go to the first page of tables. We're talking about dependent students. We were talking about a dependent student with $31,000 income. So if you, and they're at an OUS school. So what you need to do is you have to look at the leftmost column of award amounts, because those are the public four-year OUS full-time students. If you go down to 31,000, you can see that the income is going to vary. Not everyone in the $30,000 to $35,000 category is going to get exactly the same amount. But the people who are around $30,000 are going to tend to get about $3,200 as opposed to $1,700. So you can see this particular student gets a lot larger grant. If you go through this and you keep going, you can see that most students will be getting much larger grants. Some students will be getting smaller grants. They primarily would be students who are in the private colleges. In many cases, they'll be getting smaller awards than under the existing program.
So, Mr. Bender, does this one reflect the contraction of the program because of the issues around the numbers?
Yes.
So this is actually going to be the range and the size of the grants given the recommended investment.
This is the proposal that the governor's is now asking. They did ask that the program, that the awards be reduced in order to account for concerns about the cost of the program, and the adjustments that they made from their original proposal are of a nature that they reduced, they had the least impact on the lowest income. That is to say, if you looked at the earlier numbers, which we have and we could show you, and you look, compared those for the lowest incomes, there'd be very little change. As the incomes increased, the decline in awards was steeper, and the cutoff, therefore, was less than at lower income levels than before. So if you'd looked earlier at this column that we're looking at here, in the very upper left-hand corner of maximum awards, public four-year, full-time students, you can see by 50,000, if you're over 55,000, you're not getting anything. The earlier run would have had some funds going to people even in the $60,000 range.
But is it then a correct statement to say that for the 45 to 49.9 category, that in that same box that you're looking at, probably when you get to the upper end of that and then above that, that people would be getting less than they would under the way that the model is constructed currently?
If you look, let's look at that particular situation. If you're talking about people who get, let's just pick an income of 45,000 and go up from there. If you go to, these are OUS students, if you go to the eligibility requirements, you'll see that some people in that income category of 45,000 could qualify for the award. But if you're independent, you'd have to have a very large household size. So practical matters, independent students would have gotten nothing before. For dependent students, even there, you have to get very large, so there would be very few students. If you start going to 50,000, I mean, people aren't going to have big enough households to qualify. So basically, they wouldn't have gotten anything before. Now they'd be getting something.
Representative Barnhart?
Yes. I'm curious as to why the awards generally are larger for the two-year schools than for the four-year schools.
The rationale for doing that is that, two-year schools are larger than the four. Oh, I see what you're saying.
The number of dollars a student would qualify for is larger at the two-year schools than at the four-year schools. That's the, I'm wondering why that might be.
Mr. Bender, you probably have that. I know why it is.
Senator Devlin. It's because under the two-year proposal under shared responsibility, it is assumed you would not go into substantial debt. It is assumed under the four-year that you would equal out of the amount of debt that you would have for the cost for a single year. So we're anticipating, I don't remember what the number was, but we're anticipating... $2,750. You said $2,750 per year. So
I would like to comment on something that LFO holds in terms of this that probably other people sitting there would not agree with. But it is our understanding that there is no perfect shared responsibility model in the sense that there's no particular, the group that developed this came up with a particular structure that has awards that you see here. One of the outcomes of that, as Representative Barnhart noted, is that in many cases, two-year students get more than four-year students. In other cases, if you look, you'll see that in some cases, as your incomes go up, your award amounts go up. There are a number of outcomes here. And it is our position that you as a legislature can make design changes if you want and not have to accept, you know, if there are outcomes here you don't like, you can make the changes. One of the things we can do is we've got the numbers here of recipients. If you gave us, for example, a different award schedule, we could plug it in and estimate how much it would cost based on at least this model's estimate of how many recipients there are in all these different categories. But, you know, if there are things in here, when you, and I'm going to get back briefly to the issue that Representative Morgan raised. We are still concerned in LFO that the numbers that you see here, which is the proposal of the revised governor, the governor's revised proposal, in which award amounts, especially for the higher incomes, are reduced from the earlier proposal, we do not believe that that is likely to be affordable at the $47 million. What we believe is that at the $47 million, if you approve that, what's going to have to happen is the awards will have to be lowered in order to make the program not cost more than the funds that you're making available to it. So we still do not believe that these award levels that you see here are likely to cost only $47 million, which is to say $73 million the second year.
And what is the basis of your doubt?
Our doubt is that when you look at the number of recipients that this model is projecting, specifically the full-time students, we have very good data, historical data, on how many full-time students the Opportunity Grant program is serving. That program has served full-time students for many years. This is the first year it served part-time students, so we don't have good data yet. But for full-time students, this projection that you see here assumes that there will be far fewer full-time students served than there is under the existing Opportunity Grant model. And we do not think that that would really occur, given the change in the eligibility and the fact that students in much higher income categories would be eligible for awards than are now eligible.
And if I might conceptually tell us what the percentage differences are in the numbers of students in the models?
In terms of full-time students, yes, I can do that. In 2005-06, that's last year, so to know how many students got opportunity grants for full-time last year, in community colleges, 13,000 students, 13,027 exactly, got an opportunity grant at the community college level. This projection, if you looked here and you added up the numbers for public two-year full-time students on both pages, the total would be 9,310.
Mm-hmm.
That's a 28% decline from what we've observed last year. And we don't believe that that is realistic. We believe there's a problem with the projection, the model that's projecting this, mm-hmm. which was developed by consultants. Similarly, there's the projection shows a decrease for full-time students that would be served in higher ed of about 6.7%. We don't expect that to happen either. And the model shows an increase in the number of full-time students served at the private colleges of 117%. And we don't expect that to occur either. So we think there are problems.
Well, I don't know if we have time today, but I would like to hear tomorrow perhaps a little bit of a discussion about that. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if Mr. Bender could prepare, prior to tomorrow's meeting, a table similar to Table C, which would indicate, based on LFO's projections, approximately how many students would be served at different potential funding levels for the shared responsibility model.
I will be unable to satisfy your request, I regret. It's not an issue of not having enough time. It is an issue that we have concerns about the models and its projections,
mm-hmm.
But we don't have really an alternative that we can use. What we can talk about is situations where if we assume that we would actually, instead of having a decrease in community college students of 30%, we actually had an increase in 10% or 20%, we can give you what those estimates would be. What we think is going to have to happen is, basically, if you do choose to enact this model, Senate Bill 334 will be coming to this, to Ways and Means. You're going to have to look clearly at directions that you give to OSAC in order to tell them how they must adjust the model so that it costs what the amount that you're funding it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think we're going to know until after this thing has been operating how many people can serve.
Well, in lieu of providing the initial request, is it possible you can at least assume a static state? In other words, if you just take
yes.
the number of students that exist today, assume that persists into the indefinite future, just so we have some order of magnitude
You'd have an income difference
too, right?
We would have. We would just use the income levels here.
Okay.
And we,
is that possible for tomorrow's meeting?
Mm-hmm.
That would be. Thank you.
I have two questions based on what I just heard. Do we have any idea why the model produced those kind of results, which I have to admit seem very strange to me, and why we wouldn't expect, if in fact one of the major problems of community colleges is that we're overpriced, as I think we are, significant, and that's one of the reasons for the enrollment changes over the last several years. That if we substantially increase these funds available in this program, why we wouldn't expect an increase in enrollment based on that?
I would agree, Representative, that we would expect an increase. The model, again, was developed with consultants. The governor's office is also concerned about the ability of this model to project usage, utilization, and costs. They have gone and spoken to the consultants, and they have said essentially that they would not recommend any further or additional changes.
Well, again, we're going to have, tomorrow there's going to be an opportunity. Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing I wanted to ask Mr. Bender is, if you got into a situation where you had to adjust because you have too many people applying, and I think that's one of the reasons we have the bill here in the committee, is to give OSAC the ability to make those adjustments. It appears to me that you'd have two choices. You could either broadly reduce the amount of the grants, which might get you away from some of the underlying premises of the models or some of the things you were trying to do, or you could reduce the income levels for who would be eligible and not reduce the amount of the grants. In a sense, you would start lowering the maximum income levels, but you would keep the grant levels the same. You would reduce the number of students eligible versus thinning the soup is basically what you would do.
I think those are the two broadest categorizations, yeah. And there's certainly numerous scenarios.
But I think that the discussion there is around what that dynamic actually ends up looking like, because if you're looking at something on the magnitude of 30% adjustment in the community colleges, the full-time enrollment community college part of this, that's going to be a very significant change.
We haven't talked about the part-time projections. The part-time projections appear very high, as opposed to the full-time appearing very low. So
the unknown that I really have, and I think that they could help us with, is I don't know in terms of when you do this, which I think everybody has studied for a long time, how much impact it has on other aid that students might receive or how that other aid might be reconfigured. I mean, obviously there's the thing that on student loans, students that are in their first 2 years are eligible to receive a subsidized student loan at a lower maximum level than if you are a junior or senior. So there's different things that impact, and I understand there's some thing about Pell Grants potentially changing also. There's so many factors that have to be factored into this, but I think I just think there's more than is actually on the surface here.
Fortunately, college students are very predictable. Senator Decker. This is going to be the last one because I don't want the president getting angry.
I can be really quick. You're not going to get a model. I mean, this is a new national model, so in terms of getting perfection, we will have many questions, I think, whatever we end up doing. And just the consultants that we have, David Longenecker is the former Undersecretary of Education for the United States, the director of which he had, and Brian Prescott, who's a senior advisor there. They are really, in terms of higher education and pedigree, those two individuals, I think in the Western United States, but David nationally, I know are nationally known, national experts in terms of this type of work, and have been thinking and writing and looking at all 50 states for a long time. And I just know that the two names that we have listed here, the work that they do, I would just generally look upon as credible sources of information, understanding difficulties in terms of developing a new model.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, so with that, and then we'll have an opportunity tomorrow. A good discussion. I appreciate it. Mr. Bender, with that, I'm going to close the work session on 5044, and we're adjourned.